the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, we get to talk about the push for a bird flu vaccine. It's easier said than done, and a New South Wales parliamentary report into modern slavery. It's detailed harrowing stories of mistreatment and harm. It made 31 recommendations, including urgently introducing a labour hire licensing scheme and increasing enforcement powers for both the police and Safe Work New South Wales.
In New South Wales, and I suspect more broadly in Australia, migrant workers are targeted for exploitation and also find it a lot more difficult to, or not find it, I guess, find it more difficult, but there are a lot more structural, there are many more structural barriers for these people to access help, particularly if they're in regional and remote areas.
You might have some thoughts about that story or any of the other stories you hear on the program. Bird flu as well. Modern slavery, though, it's in the news today. You can send us a text. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. And let's look at that story first up, because the New South Wales parliamentary report into modern slavery has detailed the harrowing stories of mistreatment and harm. The 88-page document comes from an inquiry into modern slavery risks faced by temporary migrant workers in rural and regional New South Wales. The report said that the committee heard many horrors. It made 31 recommendations, including urgently introducing a labour hire licensing scheme and increasing enforcement powers for both police and Safe Work New South Wales. Wagga Wagga MP Dr. Joe McGurr is the chair of the committee.
Look, the temporary migrant workers are absolutely critical to the health of our regions and regional industries, particularly agriculture. And overall, our temporary migrant worker schemes, the PALM scheme, have been very successful, both for our economies and for the Pacific Island nations. Unfortunately, there is a small but significant proportion of workers who come from overseas who end up being exploited in New South Wales. And I think there's an urgent need to make sure that we have adequate labour hire regulation in this state. We are an outlier in that regard, and that's absolutely critical that we do that.
In the recommendation for a labour hire authority, what are some of the successes Victoria's had in setting that up that New South Wales could take from the report?
Well, one of the things that the Victorian system has is that it's able not just to, for example, focus on working conditions, it can also target companies that are avoiding responsibilities in terms of tax and other legislation. So it takes a very comprehensive view. It can prevent companies from, you know, going into liquidation and reappearing later. And actually the scheme's self-funding. So it's actually been, I think, on the face of it, quite successful in terms of making sure that temporary migrant workers are not being exploited in our regions. And as I say, that's important because we want people to come here and work in Australia and get the benefits of that for them, but also for our regional economies.
And as somebody who's worked in hospitals and healthcare, how much do you think migrants are suffering from exploitation that could have gone under the radar in hospitals? Is there a need for more training for staff around that?
That's one of the recommendations, is training for frontline workers in health, but also, can I say, in police services and community services to recognise people who may be at risk of modern slavery. It's no doubt that this is an underappreciated issue. And unfortunately, temporary migrant workers often have difficulties accessing healthcare from the evidence that we heard. They have to make some very difficult decisions about that. And unfortunately, they feel like they're going to be up for some significant bills, for example. And I think often people will turn up at emergency departments and be told they'll be facing a bill. They may be accompanied by a boss who's translating for them, and that's not appropriate if they're actually suffered at the hands of someone. So there's a number of issues to this, but the key item is we need to lift our game and make sure that we're aware of this potential.
Did it come as a surprise to you, the things that the committee's heard and the severity of some of these situations?
Look, I think, like most Australians, I'd be shocked to think that we invite people here to work. They come here to work to help us, and we treat them this badly. Now, in saying that, can I say that the schemes that we have in place, the PALM scheme in particular, they are highly regulated, and the vast majority of people on that appear to be doing well and getting a benefit, and it's a benefit for our Pacific diplomacy, it's a benefit for our regional industries. But unfortunately, a small proportion of people are being exploited. They leave the scheme, or they're, you know, temporary working holiday makers, whatever it is, they fall into the wrong hands, particularly of unscrupulous labour hire firms, and they end up being exploited. Now, that's not part of the Australian fair go. If people come and work here, we need to make sure that they get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, and that they're looked after, so they come back and they tell people, other people to come back and help us out.
How confident do you feel that these recommendations will be implemented by the government going forward?
Look, I think there's a fair bit of pressure on the government. I noticed that the deputy leader of the opposition has come out and said that he thinks that the labour hire scheme regulation is critical. I note the government's responses in Question Time this week seem to be firmer and stronger than they have been in the past. I think we need to keep the pressure on this government. I think there is an underappreciation of how significant an issue this is. I'm hoping this report, the recommendations, the media, the work of the Anti-Slavery Commissioner and other advocates will put pressure on the government to act.
That's Wagga Wagga Independent MP Dr Joe McGurr, the Chair of the Modern Slavery Committee, speaking with Emma Siosian. Well, the New South Wales Anti-Slavery Commissioner, Dr James Cockayne, told the ABC in a statement that the report was informed by evidence from almost 100 witnesses across New South Wales, including victims, survivors of modern slavery, and 60 submissions were put in as well. The report lays out in forensic detail why temporary migrant workers are vulnerable to this treatment, the central role that unscrupulous operators and dodgy labour hire companies play, and the difficulties those workers face in accessing health care, government and legal support and social support. Nationals leader and Coffs Harbour MP Gurmesh Singh says there needs to be collaboration between state and federal government agencies to stamp out these illegal practices.
It is shocking, and this is where federal government agencies and state government agencies need to work together to clamp down on these illegal operations, because many of the people who are involved in this have often absconded from other schemes, or they might be here on an illegal visa, or they might be overstaying a visa. So they're much more reluctant to go out and seek help from government agencies. But that's where agencies need to work together so that they can stamp down on these illegal practices.
You are the founding director of Ausgroup, and I'm sure you have a good relationship with berry companies in the region. What do you think their reaction to all of this is going to be today?
Look, I think people will be very shocked to hear of it, but obviously, as it was when I was in the industry in 2018, the good farmers will be the most shocked, because they don't want themselves tarnished by they don't want their reputations tarnished by what others are doing in the industry. And certainly I know that they'll be disgusted with the behaviour of the few that are bringing the rest of them down.
That's Nationals leader and Coffs Harbour MP Gurmesh Singh. Well, the Recruitment Consulting and Staffing Association have been watching the Modern Slavery Inquiry with great interest, and the CEO, Charles Cameron, joins me now. Good afternoon.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
Very well. So this inquiry and the wash-up, we've heard some harrowing tales: exploitation, poor living conditions, migrants being held captive, almost captive on isolated properties, even physical and sexual assault in some of these cases. Does the industry, does labour hire generally, do you think it really needs a big clean-up?
I think there are aspects of the industry, what I'll call the criminal aspects of it, Michael, that absolutely need a lot more attention and focus. It's absolutely and simply criminal, the type of activity that's being undertaken here by a select few. I think it's really important, though, and I think one of your previous commentators talked about, you know, good farmers being impacted by these really, really bad practices. All the good labour hire operators are equally being impacted, so we're very, very keen to work with any government to stamp this out.
So just a few bad apples, you know, everyone being tarred with the same brush?
Look, there certainly are a few bad apples out there, and I think it's really important that the reputable and professional labour hire industry plays a really, really important role. You know, most growers out there don't have HR practitioners and heads of recruitment to go and find workforces. They need intermediaries who go and provide a really, really important service, and many RCSA members absolutely provide that service. But look, I've been focused on this for 20 years, and I can tell you it's a really problematic area. One of the things I will start with, though, is to say, look, let's not just go and introduce more law of the same, because a lot of it's not actually working at the moment. We also need to look at what's driving the use of, criminal contracting firms in the first place, Michael.
Yeah, well, that's another issue altogether, and the links they have, organised crime, have with some of these farming groups and farming organisations, things like that. Well, that's a whole other issue. But how do you respond to those recommendations? You know, the idea of more regulation, more powers for watchdogs, maybe a licensing scheme, more powers for police.
We look at the existing schemes, Michael, and we look at Victoria and Queensland. And if we talk about, you know, good farmers versus bad farmers, and the bad farmers are the ones who are allowing these illegal operators to supply onto their properties. The simple reality is, if we look at both Victoria and Queensland schemes, both of which have been around for sort of around about 8 years now, we really only have around 3 successful prosecutions against bad farmers. Continue to allow these operators to supply. So that's not working in our view. There's a couple of reasons for that. We feel that they need to target and put all the resources into the high-risk industries. Certainly horticulture, ag is part of that, construction's another. You've only got to look at what's going on here in Victoria in our construction industry with labour hire as well. The other thing we need to do is, again, just really focus upon smart law. How is it that we can actually moderate and change the law based upon performance? So, look, from our point of view, more law won't fix the problem. Smart law with greater powers of enforcement and evidence collection is going to be critical as well, mate.
And that's what they're talking about. They're talking about more powers for police, more powers for Safe Work New South Wales. What about the idea of harsher penalties?
I would say to you that we already have really harsh penalties. If you're not complying with the Fair Work Act, Work Health and Safety Law...
So it's hard to prove it, but the penalties are there if you do prove it.
Absolutely. So I don't think it's about increasing the penalties. I think the operators out there who are continuing just to ignore them... I think an increased penalty is going to scare them off. I think greater capacity of our inspectors to go out there and actually enforce a successful prosecution is exactly what's required here.
Do you think this will stop? There is a fear that it'll stop the flow of labour and migrant labour to farm businesses because there'll be a perception that people are getting ripped off, people are being exploited.
I don't think it will. I think at the end of the day, you've got a whole heap of growers out there who are absolutely desperate. We hear it every week, Michael. They're still desperate to get humans. They can't yet rely upon machines necessarily, but they need humans out there to pick their crop. Otherwise, they rot in the trees and on the ground, mate. So I don't think it'll stop it. It certainly will increase the amount of compliance work that needs to occur, and that's where we're working with the Fair Work Ombudsman at a national level, and we're presenting a whole heap of ideas on how to make it easier for growers to identify who are the good operators and say no to the bad operators. But I'm going to come back to it. You've got to look at what's driving this. It's the cost of actually hiring people in this country has just skyrocketed, and that's what's driving them to make bad decisions, unfortunately.
Right, okay. So there's a cost pressure there people are saying, oh, well, should I do it legally? No, I'll do it illegally, and then that's the slippery slope.
Absolutely. They simply feel at some point they will analyse it and they say, as much as I want to actually use the right people and pay them correctly, I simply cannot make a profit if I do that. I do think there need to be some serious discussions around operators out there as to whether if you can't actually do it lawfully and properly, you should not be running a business. But that's a really tough discussion to have, Michael.
That's an interesting point, but generally you're in favour of changes to the regulations here in New South Wales to stamp out some of this modern slavery.
We are absolutely in support of introducing a regulatory structure and system, but again, I'll repeat, it's absolutely critical that it is targeted. So rather than actually, you know, having a scheme that seeks to license labour hire firms that hire people at, you know, for $5,000 a day in an ICT firm, let's focus on construction and agriculture and horticulture and high-risk industries because there's a limited budget for all this sort of stuff. We want to get it right.
Charles, appreciate your time on the program today.
Thank you, Michael.
It's 20 minutes past 12. That was talking about the issue of modern slavery from the recruitment side of things. Charles Cameron, who's the CEO of the Recruitment Consulting and Staffing Association. Well, let's hear from some of the other voices in regards to this issue in this inquiry, which was released last night. The non-profit Redfern Legal Centre made a submission to the report that said that the exploitation of migrant workers in rural and regional New South Wales, as well as across Australia, is endemic. Senior Solicitor Sally Feldman Gabay welcomed the report's recommendations, in which she says it echoed many of those that were put forward by the centre.
Community legal centres, I think we're on the front line, so we're often accepting referrals directly from the Anti-Slavery Commissioner, directly from Anti-Slavery Australia. We have connections direct to community groups, so people will refer workers to us because they know that we're a trusted sort of organisation that's not going to report them to the Department of Home Affairs, for example, and we might actually be able to assist them with various visa pathways by referring them to the right people or allowing them to access this workplace justice visa pilot. But I mean, as I said before, the recommendations that this report concludes with mirror largely a lot of the recommendations that Redfern Legal Centre made, which is heartening that the committee has listened to us, but it also reaffirms that the problems that we're seeing are real. So we're not, I guess we're not only getting a really specific and dim view of what's happening. Unfortunately, that is the reality that in New South Wales, and I suspect more broadly in Australia, migrant workers are targeted for exploitation and also find it a lot more difficult to, or not find it, I guess, find it more difficult, but there are a lot more structural, there are many more structural barriers for these people to access help, particularly if they're in regional and remote areas.
Now, Berries Australia CEO Rachel McKenzie says the first step in addressing work exploitation needs to be the establishment of a state labour hire licensing scheme.
Obviously, I am not the judge and jury. What I hear is anecdotal. It has been supported by some of the commentary in other places by other people. And once again, let's remember that these reports are not judge and jury. They are allegations, and those allegations need to be investigated. But until we have a robust labour hire scheme in place where we can actually track down who the perpetrators are when we do in fact make reports, then we can't even start. So I think that's where we should start with the New South Wales Labour Hire Licensing Scheme. Let's get that in place. Let's lock it down. In Queensland, we've gone from more than 90% non-compliance to 8% non-compliance, and most of that is paperwork. So let's do the thing that works and not speculate around the other things. And also, I think it's really important to point out that in that report, they said 98% of participants in the PALM scheme from an ANU independent report said they would recommend participating in the scheme to their friends. So let's not think that this is widespread, systemic, entirely indicative of the working conditions across the berry industry or, in fact, horticulture. It's not acceptable, but it's not everyone.
And CEO of Berries Australia, Rachel McKenzie, spoke to Samuel O'Brien about the claims that there is knowledge within communities about the operation of labour hire syndicates.
I'm not aware of any specific examples. I have been told that there are some concerning behaviours, but I've also been told by my own members that they are sick and tired of being dragged through the mud by the dodgy operators and the dodgy labour hire companies. And as the Modern Slavery Commissioner himself points out, many of the growers are frightened to speak out because of these powerful syndicates working in the region. This is criminal activity run by criminals, and that we need to address this behaviour.
Do you think that we can get to a point where the culture shifts to where farmers feel like they can speak out when they see there's something going wrong?
Look, farmers already do speak out, and I certainly have made reports, not recently, to the Fair Work Ombudsman, because it's important that those allegations are investigated. And many times they don't actually turn out to have any substance to them, but it's really important that people feel that they can report. And I think that they already do. The trouble is when the Fair Work Ombudsman comes to town, everybody scarpers and clears out, and there's no fruit picked that day, and the Fair Work Ombudsman finds nothing because they're too slow, the time lags are too long, and the companies that they're looking for, which are these labour hire companies, have probably phoenixed three times since they actually did the investigation.
That's Rachel McKenzie, who's the CEO of Berries Australia. I'm getting quite a few texts on this. Someone's texted in to say that the NFF Horticultural Council and most hort bodies have asked both parties who've governed over the past 5 years for the federal labour hire licensing scheme to be set up. Governments have failed to put the stop gaps in, and it must be federal. Awards are federal, border force are federal, ATO is federal. Penalties are already harsh, but we need to have a federal licensing scheme, this person is saying. And another text coming in saying the idea that it's a few bad apples, good farmers disgusted by the revelations, most growers doing the right thing. This person is saying rubbish. Every investigation shows the rules are being broken. NRA water investigations show constant illegal water use, illegal dam construction, workers are being exploited, there's illegal clearing. They go on in that text there of a few examples of that as well. It's 26 minutes past 12 on the Country Hour.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
And it's 27 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour. Well, to some court news now. A group of more than 100 climate activists are in the Newcastle court today, with New South Wales Police withdrawing the charges against them over their involvement in an on-water protest in Newcastle. The Rising Tide protest of 2024 aimed to disrupt coal loader movements out of the port of Newcastle, which is the busiest coal port in the world. ABC Newcastle reporter Bridget Murphy was in court today. Good afternoon.
Hello, Condo.
So, Bridget, remind us of what happened at this protest in 2024.
So we saw a massive group of protesters take to the water at Newcastle Harbour, as you mentioned, and they were in kayaks, canoes, different sort of vessels that they had constructed. And the aim was to disrupt the shipping channel that comes through Newcastle Harbour into the port of Newcastle, which, as you mentioned, is not only one of the biggest coal ports in the world, but also is quite involved in grain exports and those sorts of things. So it did create a lot of disruption at the time. There was the protest in 2024, which was the focus of today's court hearings. There was also some protests in 2025 as well. But in court today, New South Wales Police withdrawing charges against 125 protesters that were facing various charges in their involvement. And at the time, there were more than 170 arrests made for that on-water protest back in 2024.
And did they have to give a reason why they withdrew those charges?
Well, they were quite vague in terms of the information that they gave to the ABC. So we did receive word from the police force. They said they've withdrawn the remaining charges specifically for the 2024 gathering. There's charges for folks that were involved in the 2025 protests that they still remain before the courts. But the police, a spokesperson told us, the decision followed a review of the outstanding matters, taking into account outcomes of cases that were already determined by the court. A few months ago, we had some protesters that had their charges against them dropped. And the police spokesperson also said the available evidence in the remaining prosecutions was taken into account. So we heard that from police today, clearing these charges from these people that took part in 2024.
And what did those arrested and charged say at court today?
Well, they had a range of views. Many thought that the decision to pursue legal action from New South Wales Police was excessive and breached their right to protest. And also, we are hearing from Rising Tide that plans are afoot for more similar protests. They plan to do a smaller version of what they have done previously later this year, and then do a similar Newcastle blockade early next year. Now, those details are still being worked toward, but many of them said that even this this process where they have been before the courts and have had these charges against them, while it has been distressing to them, it hasn't stopped them pursuing what they believe is right. So we will wait and see what happens toward the end of this year and next year to see if this does act as any sort of deterrence or if we'll see arrests and charges into the future.
But at the moment, the way it stands now, the groups say that they are planning more action. Is that right?
Absolutely. They've made it clear that early next year there will be a port blockade is what they're calling it, the blockade of the world's largest coal port. That's how they advertise the idea, and that they are actively planning that action for early 2027.
Okay, well, appreciate the fact that you're able to report on this court case for us. Bridget, thanks for that.
Thanks, Michael.
It's coming up to 12:30 here on the New South Wales Country Hour, and it's time to get some news headlines now, and Adam Story's there. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The US is facing mounting questions about the state of its military arsenal as a negotiated with agreement with Iran over the strait remains somewhat elusive. The president has denied US media reports that the US has gone through much of its highly accurate long-range missiles during the war. The president is quoted as saying, "We have literally massive amounts of munition." However, he also acknowledged that inventories of others are limited as the US faces demands for its weapons, not just in the Iranian conflict zone. The deputy prime minister says it was the Home Affairs minister's decision to postpone a speech outlining the government's new migration policy. Mr. Burke was set to unveil the changes at the National Press Club yesterday, but the speech has now been delayed indefinitely. Richard Miles has played down reports that the delay was due to internal disagreements about the policy. A federal court judge has described the Commonwealth's claims against the chemical manufacturing company 3M for PS contamination at defence bases as daunting. The Commonwealth has filed a 1,600-page statement of claim about alleged soil and water contamination at 28 bases across Australia. Justice Catherine Button said she'd never seen a claim like it and characterised it as daunting. And counsel for 3M has said the company's defence will involve complex science. That matter returns to court in October.
Right. They've been working on that brief for a while, but the sound
of
things...
Sounds like there's a lot of weekend reading there. Yeah. And a US court has ordered Meta, the Facebook owner, to pay $800 million for its failure to warn the public about the dangers its platforms pose to children. The judge in New Mexico said the social media giant is a public nuisance taken to air pollution and that it must put the money in a fund aimed at reducing future harms. Meta says it will appeal against the ruling and that it's been working to identify and remove harmful content from its platforms.
So it'll go back to court.
Sounds like it.
Mm. And you'll be back at 1 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll be listening. As
it
usual.
Is, it is Friday, isn't it?
That's yeah. right. We'll be, yeah, yeah. Don't worry, we'll be listening. We'll be listening till 7 yeah. o'clock.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for that,
All
Adam.
Right, okay.
Talk See to you ya. Later. Adam Story there with the news headlines. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. Ed Medlock's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So, Ed, the front's coming through. Is it starting to come through? Is it tomorrow?
Yes, that's right. It's sort of sitting in the bight right now, so quite far west of New South Wales. Looking like it's going to start coming through maybe Saturday afternoon, so you'll see some showers in the far west starting then. But tomorrow morning we're expecting more frosts pretty broadly.
Right.
Across the inland, because that high is still sticking around. It's making the most of it on Sunday, where most areas of southern New South Wales we'll experience some moderate showers, some moderate rainfall totals, as the showers are quite widespread across those inland areas. Pretty much everywhere west of the Divide is probably going to see at least a little bit, but most of the southern inland and also spreading up into the central west is going to experience around the 10 to 20, maybe 10 to 30 millimetres of rain at the very least.
So mainly focused in the south of Riverina, you think, and maybe like 10 millimetres in the central west. Is that what we're looking at?
It's actually beefed up a little bit in the central west in the latest modelling. It's closer to 10 to 20 in the central west. It was closer to 5 to 10 yesterday, but it's getting up there now. So Dubbo and Orange and even Cobar, which is a little bit further west, all looking like the 10+ millimetre range for Sunday.
So some decent falls, but where's the cutoff point? Where's it going to sort of be quite a lot less rain?
Yeah, cutoff points, New England and kind of northwest of that area. So Tamworth, Armidale probably will not get much on the Sunday. It does make its way through on Monday to those more northeastern areas. So they might catch 10 mils or so on the Monday once the front makes its way there. But as far as the Sunday is concerned, it doesn't quite make it to that New England area.
Right, okay. And a little bit on the coast or not really?
Not really. I mean, there will be showers and sprinklings around the place, so they'll probably be like slightly wet, but it's not going to be more than 5 millimetres at most places, because they're in that rain shadow, of course.
And what about the issues for Coonabarabran, Coonamble, Walgett? Were they going to get some of this rain too?
Yeah, all those areas are probably going to get a fair decent amount of rain. Again, 10+ for all those areas. Coonamble as well, for sure.
Okay, all right. So, okay. And what about the southeast? Because I always get text people asking me about the southeast, the Monaro. They say they need a bit of rain.
Yeah, Monaro is probably the last place that'll see once it gets past there. It drops off pretty steeply. So if you're on the coast, if you're on like the big coast, you'll probably not see much. But the Monaro Alpine areas, Cooma's expecting to get just about 10 millimetres. And then after Cooma, it drops off quite sharply.
Okay, all right. So I think that's a fairly comprehensive run through of what we can expect. What about the after this moves through, is a high pressure coming in or not really?
Not quite yet. There's a couple more kind of weaker fronts and troughs moving through afterwards. Should also mention that it's going to be pretty windy on the Sunday along with that front, and that wind kind of sticks around for quite a few days throughout next week. So there will be continuing showers about the Riverina and mostly about the Snowy Mountains and southwest slopes as a result, since there'll be some pretty strong westerlies all the way through next week. And the next high is probably going to come through around maybe Thursday, maybe Friday next week. So we'll be returning to some of that more stable weather with those morning frosts.
So a few showers there in the meantime. Yeah, but not a big dump of rain, but if just a few showers continue until the end of the week.
Yep, and windy.
Okay, all right. Ed, thanks for that.
Thanks, Michael.
Ed Medlock with the details of the weather for the next week or so. It's coming up to 23 minutes to 1 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, to bird flu now, vaccinations could be an option for Australia's commercial egg and chicken producers to combat the deadly H5 bird flu, but not just yet. Ryan McMonies is Managing Director of the National Representative Body Australian Eggs. He says there are still some hurdles to overcome before producers can start vaccinating their birds.
There's some significant complexity in relation to HPAI vaccination. I should make it clear they're vaccinating for a range of other production diseases to protect their flock. But for HPAI vaccination, the current policy doesn't really permit, that's government policy, doesn't really permit HPAI vaccination. It is, however, the subject of somewhat of a global movement. It's being explored by a range of other countries, many of which are ahead of us in terms of their HPAI journey. They've had it for a while. They've incurred significant losses. That's made them more interested in assessing HPAI vaccination. There is a good example of in France, where they've looked to vaccinate their duck populations and protect them. That's now, it's effectively a big old trial that everyone's able to observe because it's been running for a few years. And there's aspects of that everyone's been able to learn from. But we're now seeing other countries, other jurisdictions explore it in earnest. There's trials going on in the UK, the Netherlands, in Italy. And I guess everyone's interested in better ways to manage the level of the virus, which is what vaccination does. And if there's net benefits in doing so, it would make a lot of sense in exploring it. We've been exploring it in Australia, but we're not there yet. We're still stepping through some of the issues and the complexity. We, as Australian Eggs, has tried to fuel that process by drawing on research and expertise from overseas and make it available here. But there's policy development processes that have been going on some time. It would be interesting to see whether or not they accelerate in response to the detections that we've seen of HPI in Australia, but I'm not aware of whether they will or not. I am aware, being relatively close to it, that there's some complexity and still some work that needs to be done. Our objective was to do as much of that work as possible before we had a detection and try and get ahead, because there's not much point deciding at some stage that you'd like to, but you've got multiple years of issues and work to get through, and through that period you're going to experience delays and losses. In this case, the vaccines are there. There's just other complexities around how it would actually operate. And I think even though it's been suggested that we have discussions around, well, who would pay for what, how could this work, where the government seem to be at the moment is to say, well, we need to define it first. You know, you need to define what we would be doing, and then we could talk about who's going to pay for it. But I'm aware from my engagement that there is an openness within industry to pay to some extent if there's an economic benefit in doing so. But another one of the tricks and complexities with vaccination is that there are multiple beneficiaries, including, for example, what we're seeing at the moment is an impact on wildlife. Everybody wants to see that limited because we care about our wildlife. But the question is, well, who pays, and who pays to recognise that benefit? I don't think you'll find any particular industry is in a position to, you know, make investments for the public good. You know, that's more of the government space as to whether or not vaccination's feasible and has net benefits in Australia, how much it will cost, and how those costs should be shared.
That's Australian Eggs Managing Director Ryan McMoney speaking to Richard Hudson about the possibility of commercial egg and chicken producers vaccinating against H5 bird flu. Now, testing at CSIRO today has confirmed a further 32 positive detections in South Australia. There are now 155 confirmed or presumed positive detections of H5 bird flu in Australia based on the samples that have been tested, but there remains no detection in agricultural production systems, and the risk to human health remains low. Just a reminder that bird flu hotline number is 1-800-675-888 if you see dead or dying birds. Give them a call, 1-800-675-888. It's coming up to 19 minutes to one.
This week on Country Breakfast, the likely impact of bird flu on Australian wildlife is coming into focus, with fears the disease could wipe out entire species. Listen live to ABC Radio National at 6 a.m. or via the ABC Listen app.
Well, a project to track feral deer movements across the Port Macquarie region using GPS collars has revealed the animals aren't roaming very far. The project began in April and is collecting data over 6 months using 14 GPS collars to help inform management strategies across Port Macquarie and in peri-urban spaces across Australia. North Coast Local Land Services team leader, Operational Invasive Pests, Dean Chamberlain, says feral deer have significant impacts on vegetation and infrastructure, so these insights are highly valuable.
We've now got 14 collars out, started putting them out in April through to June, so there's 14 collars out there active sort of in the Port Macquarie City area, and then a three down towards Lake Katawai. The collars actually provide a 5-minute fix of where the animals are, and that's how we're sort of working out what areas the animals are using around Port Macquarie.
So what are some of the insights you've been seeing so far?
It's pretty interesting stuff, some of it. They appear to have relatively small home ranges of about 20 hectares, so they're basically sticking within the vegetation corridors and then, you know, moving out into the urban areas from there. They have a fairly high fidelity, so they're not wandering far out of that home range. Occasionally they have a bit of an excursion and go walkabout, but they tend to move straight back into those areas as well. So that's interesting in itself. And then there's not a lot of interaction between the collared deer themselves. They might cross over into the same sort of areas, but not generally at the same time. So it does give us an indication that, you know, we've got 10 collars up around Port Macquarie itself and 10 individual mobs sort of moving around. And then from some of the feral scan reports we get from people, we can sort of say that the deer that they're actually seeing aren't our collared mobs because they're not there at the same time. So it is giving us a bit of an insight into possible numbers, and hopefully we can get a better idea of just how many are floating around over time.
Yes, do you have an estimate?
It's a really good question. We know there's about 100 floating around with the 10 collars, say, at Port Macquarie itself in the city area, and quite easily from the feral scan reports and other areas where we know there's deer where we don't have a collared animal, then it could be 2 to 3 times that or more.
Has that been a steady increase in numbers that you've seen in recent years, or do you think there's been that volume for a while now?
There's probably been an increase. I mean, the potential increase is about 40% a year without control or management. So there's definitely been an increase. And I think from feral scan reports over the years as well, they've increased quite a lot. And the numbers seen in reports have increased significantly as well. So that suggests that the population is probably still increasing in some areas.
What are the main concerns about that population?
It's all the impacts that they create, and, you know, it's on the urban areas, on parklands and plantings and stuff in there. It's on people's gardens, and, you know, even incidents with motor vehicle strikes. And, you know, unfortunately we had one animal struck already and killed, one of our collared ones, so we lost one of those after about a fortnight from a vehicle strike. So they're some of the main issues that people have got. They basically destroy gardens and destroy plantings.
How long's this tracking program go for?
The collars will be on for 6 months, and then we'll sort of look at the data. But we're also using telemetry to track them in real time, so a VHF telemetry system to track them in real time at different times as well, to actually try and increase our effectiveness in management as well. So we're trying that to add another bow to our string, as you say, to try and, you know, use as many control tools as we can. Most of the collars are providing similar data as to what the animals are doing, so that should help us focus control down the track as well, because we know, you know, if we're going to control animals across a broad landscape, then we actually have to move into that landscape to get good management.
Dean Chamberlain from North Coast Local Land Services speaking there to Emma Siosian.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the head of New South Wales Minerals Council says mining communities have never held more power politically ahead of next year's state election. Stephen Galilee says the industry has become increasingly politicised, and more people in and out of mining are taking their votes very seriously.
I've never seen a more uncertain political landscape to what we've seen right now. And when we just saw another poll showing One Nation just nosing back in front of the Labor Party again, and, you know, the combined, I guess you would call, right-wing vote well over 50%. So it's going to be fascinating to see how the next state election pans out. Because we have an optional preferential voting system, it's very hard to tell, you know, what outcomes might be in some seats where previously you would be able to say with some confidence which party is going to win. And that's no more so the case than here in the Hunter Valley and across some of our other mining seats across the state in the central west and far west of New South Wales. And, you know, we're going to see, I suspect, if the polling continues in the way that it's been reported so far, some very interesting outcomes. The results in some of those mining seats that we have, you know, lots of people from the industry living and voting in, will determine, in my view, whether or not, you know, the Labor Party, for example, is able to form a majority at the next state election, whether there'll be a minority government of some form. It could be a Labor minority government, or it could be some other form of minority government, or potentially, given the Premier has ruled out, you know, a deal with One Nation after the next state election, that may be the only option for him to form some kind of government on the floor of the Parliament. And if that's ruled out, then we could be back to the polls before we know it to see if somebody can put a government together. So I've never seen it a more interesting and uncertain time in politics. And, you know, from an industry perspective, you know, it's important for us to protect our people and protect our community in that context, and that's what we've been doing.
Yeah, so that sort of uncertainty politically, what does that lead back to? And looking ahead to even the next 3 years or so, given the political landscape, how is the industry feeling?
Well, you know, every 4 years we get one day as the people to tell the politicians what they should do, whereas most of the other time they're telling us what we should do. So as voters, we need to make the most of that opportunity, and as an industry we need to as well. And if the many mining seats across the state are going to throw up results which are going to impact heavily on the final outcome of the on the floor of the parliament. We need to make sure that we've got good candidates running in those seats, no matter from what political party or what their political background might be, because as an industry, we've generally been very lucky to have good, strong, vocal, local, effective representatives for our communities who have supported our industry and our role as an industry in their local communities, and who have been prepared to stand up for our industry, whether they be from the Labor Party, the National Party, in some cases the Liberal Party, but also, you know, obviously, you know, the independents that we've had in the Parliament as well. Now we've got One Nation who, you know, look like they're potentially going to do very well as well. So it's important for us to engage with them too and make sure that we're going to have quality candidates from right across the spectrum contesting those seats so that the final outcome is good for those local communities where our people live.
Stephen Galilee is the CEO of the New South Wales Minerals Council, and he was speaking there with Emilio Bernasconi.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Geelong Football Club has avoided penalties for signing a deal with a player to assume legal responsibility for future possible brain trauma. Meanwhile, the federal government attempts to get state and territory ministers to lock in national standards for men's behavioural change programs and join a small group of Victorian adventurers heading underground to experience what they say is the last frontier of true exploration. Under the earth. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
But here on The Country, our native birds cause an estimated $300 million of damage to fruit and grain crops each year. A new high-tech solution called Robird is being trialled. It's a drone that mimics a bird of prey to keep avian pests away. Landline's Helena Bachkowski takes a look at this robotic raptor.
Invented in the Netherlands and now owned by a Canadian company, the Robird is being trialled in the skies above Australia's horticultural crops.
But what is it?
Ben Gray is the Australian lead for Robird.
It's a drone that's modelled off a biomimetic falcon.
What's a biomimetic falcon?
So instead of a normal, say, fixed-wing drone that will, like, glide and be propelled via a propeller, it works on flapping its wings, which makes it a pretty unique tool, I guess.
Robird was initially commercialised to eliminate bird strikes at airports, but since being taken over by the Canadians, it has been put to a different use.
Its aim is to imitate a predatory bird and create, I guess, a predatory presence in an area and reduce the amount of bird damage in crops.
Bird damage costs Australian horticulture $300 million a year. Brought to Australia by Hort Innovations, they've been testing this model and others since last November as part of a three-year trial. Andrew Francie is Hort's General Manager of Industry Services.
The results have been encouraging. There's more work to do right around the country, though, to prove this technology.
Has the data started coming in, and if so, what have you learnt?
So we've learnt that early stages, crop losses are reduced by 89%. And that's in almonds and now strawberries. We've got more work to do. So we're going to be trialling this technology from apples to almonds, from cherries to strawberries, right across the country in different conditions so we can prove the technology works.
Drone operators Jim Kleiney and Harry Legastis work solely on the Robird project.
So I'm just checking over all the control surfaces, the actual wings themselves and the tail panels, as well as our elevators and ailerons, making sure everything's all tight. There's no tears or fatigue points happening, as well as obviously your propeller, make sure it's not chipped anywhere or it's free spooling.
Jim, what's it made from? It looks like a core flute or a cardboard.
Yeah, so the main body itself is 3D printed plastic. The wings are a bonded styrofoam, effectively, with some carbon fiber reinforcement inside. And then the tail, due to weight constraints, is cardboard, but it is reinforced with carbon fiber as well. So it gives it that lightweight rigidity.
Beside the predatory actions of the machine, Ben Gray says they're looking at the impact the Robird is having with a whole-of-ecosystem approach, taking into account the way birds move, and feed within that system.
In an agricultural context, you have very, very complex sort of range of insects, birds, whole heap of different organisms interacting within that sphere. So it's really important to understand what is causing the damage and then targeting that.
Farmers can usually point to the birds they see feeding in their crops, but the team says a second assessment is critical. By identifying the species causing the damage, they can tailor a response that protects crops without disrupting the wider ecosystem.
So it might not be to fully remove a bird from an area, because those birds might be important in that sort of ecosystem. So we try and establish, I guess, the minimum amount of management that is needed to reduce that bird presence in the area.
Bird behaviouralists are often sceptical about the next big thing to mitigate birds on farms. Is this latest tech on track to do the seemingly impossible?
Daryl Jones is a Professor Emeritus at Griffith University. Professor Jones started studying bird solutions for cropping in the 1980s.
Every time there's a new gadget coming out, I seem to get asked to have a look at it, you know, which is an exciting sign now what's going on. But it's also really depressing in terms of the sense that some of these things are being sold as the final solution, and they never really are.
And like many journalists before us, Landline also asked for his opinion, this time on the Robird.
I think the Robird is likely to be much more successful than other using tech, because it mimics a real live predator, and that's what we really want. That's what they're trying to do. Now, the problem, of course, will be this, do the birds just get used to it?
Good question. I asked it of Ben Gray.
Will they just get used to it and go, oh, this is a no threat at all?
So generally when you have a deterrence tool, you will have that initial sort of, I guess, novel removal factor of the tool, which will be really high, and then you'll decrease in time, which is called habituation. So we have seen kind of the opposite of that, which is really exciting.
That's Landline's Helena Bachkovsky, and you can see the Robird in full flight this Sunday at 12:30 on Landline, or any time on ABC iView. Well, let's turn our attention to guns now. State Parliament has been told compensation for a gun buyback scheme in New South Wales could reach $1 billion. With regional areas most impacted, the state and federal government passed sweeping new regulations last year that put limits on the number of guns an individual can own and reclassified certain firearms. New South Wales and the ACT are the only jurisdictions to fully sign up to the national gun buyback scheme so far. Libertarian MLC John Ruddock spoke about the issue in New South Wales Parliament yesterday.
Mr. President, I give notice that on the next sitting day, I'll move one, that this House notes with alarm that New South Wales firearm dealers are facing financial ruin after gun buyback legislation was rushed through this Parliament following a tragedy, and A acknowledges these laws wrongly targeted law-abiding gun owners who were blameless regarding the Bondi terrorist attack, and B that family businesses have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales, and see that regional dealers report collapses of up to 80% of revenue, with staff laid off, hours slashed and doors closing amongst the state's roughly 100 shooting industry businesses, and D, that Tulipwood Economics report estimates that an accurate compensation figure would be approaching $1 billion, and E, that we must defend individual rights and free enterprise, not collective punishment of farmers, competitive shooters and heirloom owners for the crimes of terrorists, and that this House calls on the New South Wales Government to A, publish a timetable that spells out how a compensation package will operate, since these businesses are innocent victims of government behaviour.
That's Libertarian MLC John Ruddock speaking in Parliament with his views on the impacts of the gun reforms. It's time to go to markets. And now to Griffiths for the Sheep and Lamb Report.
Good afternoon. The lamb numbers eased to 4,850. The quality was good, with plenty of heavy and extra heavy grain assisted lambs. Most of the trade weights were Dorpers or Merinos. The market was firm. Light Merinos under 18 kilos sold from 138 to 196 to average 1,020 cents. Trade lambs 20 to 24 kilos 236 to 271. They averaged 1120 to 1180. The 24 to 26 kilo lambs 288 to 294. Heavy lambs 30 kilos range from 314 to 355 or 1160 cents. Extra heavy lambs to 36 kilos sold to 388 and averaged 1070. Super heavy lambs topped the market at $425. Heavy merinos reached $330 or 1100 cents. Mutton numbers eased and the quality was good with plenty of heavyweights. Prices were cheaper by backed by about $20 to $30. Heavy merinos 222 to 270. Crossbreds reached 278 and most range from 770 to 820.
And that's the market information for today. You've been listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. Just a reminder about that bird flu hotline number. And it's 1-800-675-888. If you see any sick or dying birds, make sure you report it to the hotline. 1-800-675-888. Maybe getting some rain over the weekend. If you want some rain, I hope you get it. It's coming up to news time.